Trump publicly introduced the new head of the White House Corona Virus Task Force, Dr. Scott Atlas. He's a radiologist with no experience in infectious diseases. His ideas frequently line up with Trump as opposed to science. In an April op-ed in The Hill, Atlas warned against mass isolation measures that nations were taking, seeking to head off the spread of the virus. From WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Chris Garlock here. Ed Smith, you are listening to Your Rights at Work. Thanks so much on this rainy, rainy Thursday. But hey, Ed Smith, the humidity is down. It is all good.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been brutal. I was in negotiations yesterday and the day before, and anytime I went outside to take a break, it was, oh. So it's nice to have a relaxing summer rain.
Absolutely, absolutely. Hey, we have a great show lined up for you today. In just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by none other than your favorite people, Liz Davis from the Washington Teachers Union. As you might have just heard a little bit there, they're doing a really cool thing on Saturday. It is called, let me get this right, Getting It Right, Reopening Our Nation's Schools. And I'll tell you what, that is going to be quite the test. So we're going to talk to Liz in just a minute. In fact, I see she's getting online now. Let me just go over the rest of the show. Also, at the half, remember Spud Wrench? Remember Spud Wrench?
I sure do.
All righty. Spud Wrench has got a new one out. You're going to love it. It's called Old School Mechanic. Spud Wrench, of course, is the singing elevator constructor, and you're going to really like it. So it's a great song. Looking forward to that one. And then after that, Christopher Martin, he's a professor of digital journalism. He's got a new book out called No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class. Not a big surprise there, right, Ed Smith? This is not exactly news.
You know, Chris, once again, with titles, there you go. I know you like seeing great titles.
I love a good title. Yes.
That one makes you want to open the book, I think.
Yeah, well, we're going to have Professor Martin, I should say, on to talk about that. Hey, where'd Liz go? I just saw Liz and now she's gone. All right, let's see if we can get her.
she heard me and she ran the other way.
Has that happened to you a lot, Ed?
Not as much as I probably more than I think.
Hey, give folks a number they can call if they have questions about their rights on their job. And here's what I was thinking, Ed. Right now, with all this stuff going on with people, you know, being told to go back to work, and, you know, I was reading an article about, you know, a lot of these essential workers who are really, you know, being treated like dirt right now. Some of them, you know, like the supermarket workers are getting a few extra dollars an hour. That's been pulled back. They're kind of getting it from management and they're getting it from, you know, folks that are just sort of fed up with the pandemic that's going on and on. So it's going to be real interesting, I think. So if you're out there, you know, working and wondering about what are your rights? I mean, what if your boss tells you, you know, you got to enforce one of these, and I pay attention. I wear my mask when I go out, but what do you do, when you have to deal? What's the number they should call, Ed?
Hey, so if you're interested in having a chat either about what's going on right now or any issues you have at work, other than COVID-19, feel free to call at 202-588-0893. And Chris, you know, now that you mention that, there was an incident yesterday. I won't say what hospital it was, but a nurse had been out of the area And according to D.C. According to Mayor Bowser's executive order, if you're out of the area, you've got to quarantine for up to 2 weeks. And so she came back and was told by occupational health, don't come to work. We'll let you know when we clear you.
And then,
of course, a few hours later, a supervisor's trying to make her report to duty. Fortunately, we have a union, and the union got it stopped immediately. There you go. The manager, you know, you almost can't blame the manager because the manager knows she needs nurses to.
Sure, absolutely.
The census is going up in terms of having patients. They're moving closer to full capacity on that particular unit. So the manager's trying to get workers, but she knows that occupational health says she can't return to work. And she tries to do it anyway. But fortunately, because we have a union there, it got quashed.
202-588-0893 if you want to comment or if you've got questions. I believe we've got Liz. Liz Davis, are you there? I see a phone there. All right, we're gonna try and get Liz on there. I see Mike Nasella his magic. She's here. Yeah, we've got to get her unmuted. All right. Anyway, we're working on getting Liz Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union, online to talk about this big town hall that's coming up on Saturday right here in WPFW starting at noon. And it's going to run for 4 hours. It's called Getting It Right, Reopening Our Nation's Schools. It's got like an all-star lineup. It's pretty amazing. So we're going to talk with Liz about that in just a second. But in the meantime, a little feedback there. Ed, I had a couple of headlines I wanted to share with you, some good news. We have some victories. We always like victories, and we don't get them as often as we should. A couple of things. Just up 95 in Philadelphia, my old hometown, the workers at the museum, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, have unionized. I think they got 89% majority. Not bad, right? Oh, I think we lost Ed there. Jeez, we've lost Ed. We lost Liz. Oh, my gosh.
Well, Liz is back.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, that's fine. Ed can do whatever he wants. As long as I got you, Liz, I'm good.
And I actually heard you say, is Liz there? And I went to push unmute and I pushed hang up.
We got you now. Liz Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union. And I tell you, Liz, doing this Zoom stuff, this is kind of what you're talking about, right? I mean, this is stuff that we've had to learn. And I know I talked to you earlier in the year when you guys were doing the stuff with the television stations. I mean, we are in a whole other world when it comes to, talk about, learning some new tricks. So what's happening with this town hall on Saturday, Getting It Right, Reopening Our Nation's Schools?
Oh, absolutely. And of course we're being joined by, union leaders, teacher union leaders from across the U.S., a few experts in the health profession, Dr. Reed Tuckson, to talk about what it really means to reopen schools safely. And we do know that some jurisdictions, we're thankful that D.C. Chancellor decided to reopen 100% distance learning. I don't know if that was the initial goal, but we have to apply a little pressure there, Chris, to ensure that our schools would be safe. Our teachers naturally want to return to in-person teaching as soon as possible, but they want safety to be a priority for themselves and for their students. So we're glad that we're reopening distance learning. But the safety protocols that have been, and of course, CDC announced new safety protocols this morning, a new announcement from the executive director of CDC. And we have to look at the science, what is occurring in our area before we even think about sending workers or students back into our buildings. And I do know that of the 115 schools that we have in the district, Chris, many of them are old, some have been modernized, but a lot of them have faulty ventilation. And we simply do not want to put students and teachers at risk by sending them back into buildings too soon. This panel on Saturday is going to talk about recommendations that come from experts and from educators that have considered the needs of parents, the supports that teachers need, supports for students with special disabilities, ELL students, the whole nine yards, because teachers, if they're left out of the conversation, and the planning as to how we should reopen our schools, it is going to be a recipe for disaster. Our teachers are experts on knowing what is age appropriate for various groups of students, what is grade level appropriate, what platforms can be used. And they want to get the reopening right. We closed with a lot of challenges. I mean, dealing with this pandemic is extremely complex, but our teachers accessing their knowledge base, accessing what they know as experts, is critical to any reopening plans. And we're certainly hoping that this panel discussion on Saturday is going to make that point, because it will be led by experts in education and in the health profession. So go ahead.
No, I wanted to ask you, I know that you've been dealing with this. It's not like y'all took the summer off. What are some of the sort of the top things that you're hearing? And I know you're hearing from teachers. I know you're hearing from parents. I'm sure you're hearing from folks that are in the schools. What are a couple of the big concerns that you're hearing?
The main concerns are safety, Chris. And of course, we do know that we've always had inequities in terms of what students receive resources and what schools get. We have an issue with the digital, the technology for students. Mm-hmm. We basically have lobbied our council member and mayor to provide additional funds for devices, for Wi-Fi access for families. We found out that 47,000 households in D.C. do not have Wi-Fi access. 35% of our students, when we had to transition from in-person teaching to distance learning, did not have access to computers at home, which is one of the reasons why WTU partnered with Fox 5 to run lessons on TV. But we don't want to reopen with those complex. That is the problem that we can fix with the additional funds, Chris. The teachers want to get that off the table so that they can focus on some of the other challenges that we do know that we need greater professional development, how to deliver quality distance learning. Parents are concerned about the academic drop off, and teachers are as well, but we still want to be ensure that whatever plans we're going to transition to, whether it's in August 31st or later in the fall, that it's going to be a plan that puts safety first. So the priority funding, extra funding that is related to COVID-19 was not approved by our city council or our mayor. Our schools basically were left with a status quo budget. We want the city council to understand that it is impossible for our schools to institute the safety protocols that CDC, OSCE, and DC Health is calling for our schools without additional funds. That's just a no-brainer.
Let me just say, reintroduce. You were talking with Liz Davis. She's president of the Washington Teachers Union, AFT Local 6. They're doing a big town hall this Saturday right here on WPFW. Starts at noon. And it's called Getting It Right, Reopening Our Nation's Schools. Liz and an all-star cast, including the president of the AFT, Randy Weingarten, our own Askia Muhammad, and just a whole bunch of other folks are going to be on. Ed Smith, I know you've got some questions as well.
Yeah, good to hear from you, Liz. It's been a little bit of a while since we've talked, but good to hear you on the radio today. I wish I saw your face, too, but... Anyway, DCNA represents the school nurses, as Liz is well aware of, and we try to work very closely with Washington Teachers Union on a number of issues, and certainly this issue. DCNA is working on a statement and some protocols that we think are important. And the funding issue, I want to go back to that a little bit, Liz, is it's very interesting that they're not going to increase funding, but when you go to the health suites in the schools, they are small, and there is going to have to be some changes made in those health suites, putting shields up and purchasing equipment, just making sure that there's disinfectants, regular cleaning, and that costs money. What's your take on why we can understand the mayor? The mayor's always fighting with us on budget, but why did the council really not support pushing the envelope a little bit more to make sure that we're trying to prepare ourselves, as eventually we are going to be going into school, and our nurses are going to be there, and teachers are going to be there, and we're going to be dealing with a lot of little kids running around that in normal times it's hard to keep them clean anyway. They don't want to wash their hands, and they're always hugging and hanging.
Oh, man. So now you're not sketching. That's not a pretty picture you're sketching there, Ed Smith.
Well, it's
but it's a reality. Ed is painting a reality of what nurses and teachers know about kids at that age. And so, and of course, Ed, I cannot answer the question as to why the council would not automatically know that our schools would need additional funds in order to institute these safety protocols that are being called for by CDC and DC Health. The chancellor indicated that the schools were adequately funded. That might have been a signal to them that he didn't need the additional funds, but we know better. You mentioned the nursing suite. We do know that in many cases in our schools, first of all, we have to talk about whether or not every school will actually have a school nurse, because we are still having some issues with that.
Right.
But the spacing, whether or not the spacing in nursing suites, the spacing in classrooms and hallways and entryways is appropriate to do the social distancing that CDC is calling for is another matter. And it's one of the reasons why our teachers in their reopen report specified a plan for how to make that happen. They developed a checklist for every school. This checklist can be used by parents and teachers and other stakeholders to do walkthroughs before any students or teachers are asked to report to a building to see if all of those safety protocols have been instituted. Because teachers and parents do not fully trust the promise that things will be in order when students are asked to go back to our schools. We've seen evidence of that in some school districts that reopened too soon, Texas, where students were crowded together in hallways.
That's right.
And had to reclose with multiple cases of COVID being reported. So we don't want to repeat that here. And I think that it's important for the council to understand, you know, number one, I think Nelson Mandela said it better. No city, the revelation of how a city is sold is the way it treats its children, something to that effect. And we say that children are first, education is a priority. But right now, the funding that has been appropriated for our schools during this pandemic does not say that.
Liz, I got to ask you something, though, because like you, I've been following this stuff real carefully. And I got to tell you, you know, I haven't been to a restaurant in 6 months. And, you know, I love my restaurants, right? But I mean, everything I read says, you know, restaurants and bars, you know, are prime vector spots, right? And now I see these schools opening and you see these pictures, you know, and I'm just, you know, I was a teenager. I was a young kid. You know, I'm trying to imagine, you know, as Ed was just saying, you know, and you well know, you know, from being in the classroom, how are you going to get, and I don't care whether they're a first grader or a high school junior, how are you going to get these kids to wear masks and socially distance? I mean, just as a practical matter, help me to understand that.
I don't think it's practical, and I don't know what the answer is to that. Chris, I actually had to attend three funerals during this pandemic.
Oh my
two
God.
Of them.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, and I had to just, and of course, at one funeral home, social distancing was observed very well, six mm-hmm. feet apart, all chairs. You had to register, and after the seats were filled, no other people were allowed to come in.
Mm-hmm.
But I sat in that service for 2 hours with a mask on. I cannot tell you what that, you know, I could not imagine a small child being able to endure
right.
that.
Right.
After 2 hours, I felt the need to just run out of the building. It's almost impossible.
Absolutely.
Yes. You know, on that issue, I've done a couple of Zoom negotiations, but I've had my team with me in the same room, and we're wearing masks the entire time. And what you have to do is you have to go outside in an area yes. where no one's around and breathe for a little bit. You know, the other thing about face coverings, masks, is that some kids who have allergies, difficulty breathing, they're not going to be able to wear those masks. And that's something that's, you know, we're going to have to figure out how we're going to deal with that because they can certainly give, you know, infect other people. But, you know, people with severe asthma, and there are a lot of children in D.C. with health problems, others.
A lot of them with asthma problems. Yes. And of course, we do know that we had to collaborate with the WMATA about transportation needs in the reopening.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, that was, you know, one thing that did not come up was the sanitization of the buses,
mm-hmm.
the chemicals that are being used a few bus operators have already had issues with asthma attacks that with symptoms that were related to that were similar to COVID symptoms, had to be hospitalized, sent to the emergency room, only to discover that the material used to sanitize the buses was triggering the asthma. So we've got to consider that if we have kids who will be using these buses to be transported to and from schools.
Liz, let me ask you, and I know that your colleagues in Chicago actually had to threaten a strike, and you guys didn't have to do that in D.C., but I was curious just about for you to talk about the role of the union, because as we're seeing, workers being pushed to go back to work, and I'm even thinking about things with the sports, the wrangling that went on with the baseball players, and every place where you have a union, the bosses are forced to negotiate. But what about those folks? And there's plenty of charter schools here in D.C. What's happening to those folks?
Some of those schools, and of course the charters are independent LEAs. Some are opening with hybrid plans for hybrid learning, and others are doing distance learning following the DCPS's plan for the fall. But one of the issues that came up was the number of teachers with underlying health conditions. Uh-huh. We surveyed members to discover that 62% of them reported having underlying health conditions that would make them very uneasy about having to report to a brick and mortar school. Many of them live with family members who have underlying health conditions.
Right.
And a number of our teachers, at least 55% of them live outside of the district in PG County with school-aged children.
Uh-huh.
Right? So you know that child care, the situation with child care. So they cannot leave their kids and to report to a school in another jurisdiction. So we have a lot of issues to hammer out. But one of the main things is this. We do not want any worker to have to decide on whether or not they want to keep their life or their job. And in my discussion with the chancellor and the mayor, when the first plans were discussed about reopening, the initial plan was actually a hybrid in-person, partial distance learning program. But the mayor fortunately changed her mind and decided to go 100% virtually. But we could not get the question answered about what would be the option for those teachers who had underlying health conditions.
Mm.
Would they be able to opt out and do distance learning? And of course, some recommendations was, well, they can take medical leave, ADA, FMLA. Well, these teachers are not sick or not unable to work. They're
right.
Simply, they have underlying health conditions, will be able to work from distance learning and should not be forced to do otherwise. And the unions are going to have to push hard on that, Chris, to answer your question, because it's going to be a struggle. We're already hearing of some teachers who have been asked if they could possibly do summer work coaching. Our summer bridge program was to be in person. That was changed eventually. But we've got to get the details ironed out before school starts. And it's one of the reasons why our union has come up with a memorandum of agreement that we're hoping will be an amendment to our contract. Basically, it addressed issues related to COVID-19, whether or not the evaluation system is appropriate for distance learning, whether or not teachers with underlying health conditions will be able to opt out and do distance learning once we return to in-person teaching. We need to have all of those details in writing beforehand. Other than that, it's just going to be a lot of stress for teachers and other school workers, which we can avoid by having the details. And we have time now to get it right before school reopens. And we cannot do it in isolation. We've got to collaborate. And negotiations right now is the best way to get that done.
Well, Liz.
I heard you. Yeah.
Liz,
go ahead.
First of all, I really want to commend you and your union for that excellent work on the reopening plan. As you know, DCNA is also working on something. But, what's interesting is when we come back to the schools, there's some guidance out there that talks about cohorting, which is basically small groups that kind of travel together. Does the union have a position on that?
And, I haven't gotten enough details on that, Ed.
Right.
I've actually, I'm attending a meeting this evening with Ward 4 Education Alliance. They are talking about, on the agenda is the idea of pods, which
right.
will be, yes. You know, one of the concerns that comes up for me is whether or not that would exclude certain students whose parents may not be able to contribute whatever resources are needed to be a part of those pods. I'm not sure how they'll work, which is one of the reasons why I want to attend the meeting to inquire. But I don't want us to set up a situation where we're going to create more inequity for students who are, you know, who have been left behind, students who are at risk, students who are special needs, ELL, because we do know that our wealthiest parents can afford some resources that our poorest parents cannot.
Yeah,
but we don't want to set up a situation that is going to lead to more disparities and more inequity.
That's a great point. What I do like is at least people are trying to think outside the box, trying to figure out ways to keep the virus from spreading. But very, very good points, especially in this jurisdiction. You know, there is a lot of poor families. There are a lot of poor families, and we certainly have our share of health issues with children and, of course, their families that they live with.
Yeah, and I like the idea, Ed. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a
right.
great idea to say this. It shows that parents are making an effort to think outside the box.
Right.
And in cases, we may have to think about how the city can step up and possibly assist to with implementing such programs so that all students will be included and none will be left out.
Great point.
You know, whereas parents may not be able to pick up, well, the city could. I like the idea. I just want to ensure that it is inclusive of all students.
Liz Davis, it is always wonderful to talk to you. And folks, you're going to get a lot more of Liz on Saturday. Again, that starts at noon. It's a great town hall called Getting It Right, Reopening Our Nation's Schools. You'll be able to hear Liz Davis, president of the Washington Teachers Union, and a whole lot of other folks. Liz, thanks so much. I think we're going to have to check back in with you in a few weeks and see how this thing is going. But I appreciate you taking
the
time now.
Thank you for inviting me, Chris. Ed, it's always good to hear from you. We have to keep in touch. Take care.
Yeah, absolutely, Liz. Thanks so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care. All right. We got a little music coming up. And then, as promised, our guest after the break is going to be Christopher Martin. He's a professor of digital journalism at the University of Northern Iowa. He's got a new book out called No Longer Newsworthy: How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class. Find out more about that. I've got a couple more news headlines for you there, if you got a second there, Ed.
Yeah, hey Chris, let me throw a plug in. So the CDC website at cdc.gov has a really good page on frequently asked questions for school administrators on reopening schools. So if anyone in the audience is interested in doing further reading on this, it's cdc.gov.
Yeah, and here's the thing, and I just remain very, very skeptical of anything where you've got a bunch of people in an enclosed area for an extended period of time. I just think it's a recipe for disaster, and I don't think that has anything to do with politics. I think that's just science, and I think that, you know, thank God for unions that can stand up for their workers, but I just really, really worry about our folks that don't have unions. So we'll probably have to do a whole show just taking questions from folks on that.
Right.
Are you dealing with that at all, by the way? I mean, I know you got nurses, you know, in the hospitals and so forth. I mean, how's that going?
Well, so, you know, the school reopening and that obviously impacts the school nurses directly, because many of them are still laid off, and then others are doing other work, contact tracing and different case management duties for the Department of Health to try to put their hands in and help out with this pandemic. But if people go back to school, I think that definitely will be impacting hospitals around the city and certainly around the country, because more children will be getting the virus. It's just it's like, as you said, it's science, right?
Right.
If I have 500 kids all of a sudden coming back to school, right now, no one can get COVID from the school when you're in the school, because no one's in the schools. But at some point in time,
right?
At some point in time, just logically, you're going to have 500 kids, somebody going to get it, and then it could get infected to their parents, friends, you know, all that. So we will see a surge if at some point, I would think.
This is a thing they've been doing. You know, my office is at the AFL-CIO, and it's been locked down for 6 months. Did the deep clean, and they're actually taking the opportunity to do a whole bunch of work that they need to do. They don't even like us to go in and pick up stuff because, to your point, you know, right now when it's deep cleaned, it's all good. It's pristine. Right. Every time somebody goes in to get something, you know, we potentially mess it up because they don't know, you know, who it is or where they've been. So it's a real issue. All right. As promised, this is a fella. He goes by Spud Wrench. He's what we call him, the singing elevator constructor. He's from down, I want to say, is it Alabama?
I think it's Alabama.
Yeah, it's Alabama. And he every couple of months, he puts out a new tune. And he's got a really nice one. I think you're going to really enjoy this one. It is called, let me get the right name for it here. I had it. Too many things.
Uh-oh.
Old school mechanic from Spud Wrench. All right, check that out, and then we'll be back with Professor Christopher Martin. Don't go away.
He kept his cash in a wad in that old glove box of his old Chevy truck. Wasn't a day of hard work that he didn't show up. He cranked that wrench till it got tight. He stacked them rails and take them out. We wouldn't be where we are if it wasn't for guys like him. He was an old school mechanic, a giant in a trade. It's drag heat kitty cuts, a union man if they ever was. I'm just trying to live up to the standards set by that old school. His craft was antique, ran three generations deep. Dang sure in his blood. He has some mighty big boots to fill, and he sure enough got it done. With a half-cocked grin, southern and slow, he said, boys, I forgot more than y'all will ever know. We wouldn't be where we are if it wasn't for guys like him. He was an old school mechanic, a giant in the trade. Straight heat kitty cuss, a union man if there ever was. I'm just trying to live up to the standard set by the old school mechanic. All you young bucks better pay close attention, learn everything while you. Gonna have some questions. Find yourself wishing you could ask that man. He was an old school mechanic, a giant in the trade, Titanic. He kept it straight, he kitty cuts, a union man. I'm just trying to live up to the standard of that old school.
Old school mechanic from Spud Wrench. You know, he sent me a little note. He said, I've worked with a lot of great mechanics throughout my time in the trade. Some are now retired and some are still grinding, looking forward to retirement. And this song was just a way to honor them guys that taught us how to be elevator men, the true titans of the trade. I thought you'd enjoy that, Ed.
I did, and my father wasn't an elevator mechanic, but he was a diesel mechanic, and so
there you go.
Made me think of him.
That's good stuff. All right, our next guest is author of a new book, No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class. I'm not sure that that's news, but it is disturbing. It's Christopher Martin. He's a professor at the of digital journalism at the University of Northern Iowa. Professor Martin, welcome to the show.
Hey, nice to be with you guys.
Hey, what part of Iowa are you in, by the way?
I am in Cedar Falls, Iowa. It's right beside Waterloo, Iowa, and it's kind of in the northeast part of the state.
Know it well. Spent a couple of months there. One cold winter, actually. It gets cold out there on the plains.
Yeah. It's cold.
Wrong time to be going, Chris.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, it's a great new book. Let me just sort of get started here. What do you mean when you say no longer newsworthy?
Well, I just mean that the working class and labor unions don't get much coverage in the mainstream news.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the point of the, like you said, it's that's not really big news. What I do in the book is kind of trace back. I was really curious about what point that happened. And so I found that, you know, it was in the late 60s, early 1970s that there was a big shift. And so there was a lot of coverage and there were regular labor beat reporters.
Sure.
You know, 40s and 50s and 60s. And that started to shift by the late 1960s into the early 70s. And it was because newspaper ownership was increasingly consolidated into larger groups. And it was also publicly traded on the stock market. So all the financial geniuses come into these big newspaper groups and they say, instead of going for a mass audience, we want to go for an upscale class-based audience. And that's what makes the working class no longer newsworthy. It's like, we're not going to deliver to you folks. We don't really want to write stories about you folks because the advertisers want these people over here, these upscale people. That's who we're going to start writing the news for and focusing on. And it wasn't like, you will not find a memo saying, you know, that we're doing this, but it, right. You know, it kind of trickles down. When you work for any organization, the financial imperatives at the very top of the organization just kind of seep down and become common sense. And that's what happened in the news industry.
There's a really good review of the book in Jacobin by Luke Savage. And he, one of the things he said I thought was really interesting, he said the media doesn't talk much about working class America, but when it does, it mainly has one thing to say about it. It's entirely white, male, and very right wing. All these things are lies. And I thought that was really interesting because I think a lot of people do, you know, buy that story. Why are those things lies, do you think?
So, obviously there's the working class is much broader. I mean, there's over 160 million people in the workforce, or at least prior to the
right.
prior to conditions. So there's a lot of people, and I like to use the definition of Michael Zweig. He's an economist at SUNY, and he says that about 60% of those 164 million people are working class. And the working class, he says, are people who, when they go to work or act as citizens, have comparatively little power or authority, which is why, you know, those people would, you know, why joining a labor union is a good thing. The news media, when they wrote off the working class in the late 60s and early 70s, those people were abandoned. And so they got picked up. There was another thing that emerged that actually started speaking to those people. And it wasn't the mainstream journalism, but it was the rise of a very conservative journalism, starting with Rupert Murdoch's New York Post in the 70s, the Christian Broadcasting Network, Rush Limbaugh when radio got deregulated in the 80s and talk radio became almost completely conservative, Fox News in the 90s, the internet sites in the 90s and 2000s, like the Drudge Report and Breitbart. And they picked off that abandoned working class, but just the white working class. They didn't get the full range of the working class, people of color. They didn't really appeal to women. So it really split the working class in terms of who's talking to them. So you have the mainstream that's really not talking to them. They're talking to upscale people. Then you have the conservative media talking to the working class, but importantly, not about economic conditions, but more about cultural grievances, right?
So
it's
right.
about things like, you know, gay marriage and stuff like that, that you know, really gets their ire. And so that really plays into, in the bigger picture, you can see that, you know, happening right now, right? So the
uh-huh.
people who are talked about as the base, you know, for Trump and the Republican Party are, you know, that at least part of that white working class that's really appealed to by conservative media. And I think, you know, it's both the mainstream news media. I mean, I argue in the book that it should go back to talking to everyone, you know, and be the media for everyone, not just a certain class of people. But it's also in terms of party politics, Democrats, Republicans. I mean, you need to find a way and not forget those working class people. And I think if you speak to all working class people, you know, whites and people of color, you can kind of pull everyone in.
I want to get Ed Smith on this, but I do want to ask you a question because you use the term in your title. And Ed, we had somebody on, and I'm blanking on it, but somebody on who talked about the term working class, sort of tracing that term over, I think, 40 or 50 years, how it almost vanished. Actually, for the period that you're talking about, you know, 60s and 70s, working class really kind of vanished. I think they did some sort of LexisNexis search, you know, for use of it. But of course, as I'm sure you know, in recent years, all of a sudden, you know, working class has been used a lot more, including in titles of books like yours. I'm curious. I mean, most people, you know, you ask them, will not say that they are working class, right?
That's right.
So so can you do a little sort of term definition for me? Help me out.
Well, again, I like that broad, you know, definition of working class or people who work and don't have any power in the workplace, which is about 60% of all working people. There's different ways people try to define working class, your socioeconomic status, although you could be, you know, a well-paid unionized plumber, electrician, right, and be working class. I mean, actually, I'm a professor and I belong to a labor union myself. Because professors and K-12 teachers, I think you were just talking about this, don't necessarily have a lot of protection at their jobs. But I think the news media, especially over the last 40, 50 years, when they talk about working class and show people who are working class, it's usually white hard hats. In fact, you know, if you go all the way back to Nixon, he talked about, you know, trying to win over the hard hats. He was trying to drive a wedge in the Republican or the Democratic Party in the late 60s, early 70s. And that what happened in the news media really totally fit in with his agenda there in trying to, do a divide. And Reagan carried that onward, I think, in trying to, you know, pick off the white working class. So it's for me, as a journalism professor, it's a real failure of the news media that they don't think of the working class in broader terms.
Ed Smith?
Well, you know, as you were starting to speak, Professor, I was thinking about, I used to read the Metro section of the New York Times religiously, and I can't remember when it started to change, but I remember seeing 3-4 articles almost daily on a union issue, on a working, quote-unquote, working class issue. And then obviously, like with many papers, there was layoffs. And now you look at the New York Times, and there is no question about it, far fewer stories about labor. And then the other interesting thing is I have a very good friend of mine who used to write for USA Today, and now he's with Reuters. And I would talk to him periodically about issues and why I'm not getting press. And he would just say, it's not sexy enough. You're not on strike. If you're not on strike, we don't want to hear it. We don't think it's an important story. I don't know if you want to comment on either of those.
Well, that is it. I mean, usually it takes a strike for it to be an interesting story. But the fact that there aren't labor beat reporters at most newspapers now, it used to be very common. But, you know, starting right in the early 70s, it's just kind of tailed off. So about 7 of the top 25 papers in the country have labor beat reporters. You will not find a labor beat reporter at any of the major networks, the cable news networks, or even NPR, which is supposed to be liberal, at least if you listen to people on the right. So there's been a little bit of uptick in labor coverage, in part because labor has been, you know, much more out there and in front, like, you know, the Red for Ed teachers movement, even in terms of social justice protests, which have been also involved economic issues. So we've seen more coverage, and there have been some digital outlets like HuffPost, like Bloomberg, like Politico, the Center for Public Integrity, and others, the Payday Report, that have had labor beat reporters. So we're starting to see it come in. It really hasn't come back in a big way in the mainstream media, but there are other new organizations that realize, hey, there's a whole group of people here that we're missing that could be part of our audience if we talk about what's going on in their lives.
Well, I think that it's an important point because we just our union just went through a big battle regarding a hospital in the poorest section of DC. And we had tremendous media coverage on that. And we also had tremendous media coverage with our response to the coronavirus issues. And in part, what we learned, or what I learned over time, is the more we engage with like-minded organizations that are not necessarily labor organizations, the more we develop stories that become sexy, I guess, if you will, and are not just about the labor union issue, the labor union struggle. I think perhaps maybe that's a template to move forward. Your thoughts on that?
I think so. One of the people that I quote in the book was the late labor reporter for the New York Times from the 1970s. And he talked about how it's not really a labor beat. It should just be a work beat, right? The vast majority of people work, and they have all kinds of interesting stories you could tell about if you just think about it as work and not just covering organized labor, which doesn't have the same numbers. And I always tell people, at newspapers, when they say, well, we don't have it anymore because labor, organized labor, you know, is down in their numbers. I said, well, you know, it should be about work. Because everyone works and has all, you know, there's lots of people who would actually like to be part of labor unions, and there's all kinds of barriers that have been in front of them trying to do that. So there's lots of great stories. I think right now, especially during this pandemic, I mean, everyone knows about these so-called essential workers. Someone smarter than me said, actually, it's the workers aren't essential. It's the jobs that are essential. They don't really care about the workers. But that's really brought a lot
good
of people's
point.
Attention. It's brought a lot of people's attention to people like nurses, like teachers, like meat packers and others, and saying like, wow, that's, we need those people, but we're not really taking care of those people. And I think it's really hit, important chord with people and connecting to that. I mean, not most people in their jobs can't be at home and just Zoom it in. People have to actually be there and show up for jobs. So I think that's really been an important moment. And I think actually is really a really good opportunity for news organizations to think about, wow, there's a lot of good stories we've been missing up to this point.
You had the great quote, and you were kind of getting towards that about, how you could get the labor reporters into a single booth at Applebee's, which, I think is true in terms of the labor beat. But I think that your point about covering work and workers as the broader issue, I think, is more to the point. And I guess I kind of wanted to, I don't know if it's push back or just sort of talk more. And you hit on this a little bit in some of this, citations you were saying of some of the folks. I mean, I was just thinking, Teen Vogue has Kim Kelly doing some of the best labor reporting out there for Teen Vogue. I can't tell you how many times people send me something like, what's this doing in Teen Vogue? That's just one example. I've been working for the last few years on a thing called the Labor Radio Podcast Network that I knew a few people that were doing stuff like Ed and I are doing in terms of labor radio. And there was somebody here and somebody there. And I thought, we should be talking to each other. There's now 60 of us across the country, and probably more that we just haven't found yet, but at least 60 that we know of that are doing labor radio and labor podcasts. Now, what's interesting is, these are not just shows that are doing stuff about unions. Just like we don't only do stuff about unions. We feature a lot of unions. We put them on as much as possible, but we deal more broadly with work and with labor, to your point. And so one of the things that we looked at when we're looking at, well, who should be in this network, we're like, look, if they're dealing with work and workers' issues, they don't have to be union per se. I mean, and I'll be honest, some of the ones that are only about unions that come out of an official union, I don't want to say they're boring, but maybe they tend to be a little institutional, let's say.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So what we're seeing is a flourishing of labor and work journalism kind of around the edges from
yes,
not the mainstream media. And what's interesting, and I actually didn't write so much in the book, it didn't make the final copy, but the conservative movement in the 1960s, they were really smart, and they said, well, we're not going to get into the mainstream media,
right,
and have our point of view, but we're going to start doing things like direct mail. And they did cable when it was early with the Christian Broadcasting Network. They got in early on talk radio. And I think now there are a lot more podcasts on the left and podcasts that talk about labor and work. So because I think they were the first to that that new medium as it came out. So that's an interesting thing. And I think there's a lot more talk and about Ken Kelly at Teen Vogue. I think young people kind of intuitively get this because the economy that they've inherited isn't a great one. So I think they're much more attuned to this. I have two daughters in the teens and early 20s, and they kind of get this. I mean, they get it from me around the house all the time, but they get it and their friends get it. So I think that's a really cool thing.
Well, here's one of my favorite podcasts that just joined the network, and your daughters will probably love it. I think it's called The Crimes of Capitalism. And it's these two young sisters who are really into socialism. And, it's not a labor podcast, and I mean, but they wind up talking about a lot of labor history. They wind up talking about a lot of worker issues. And I remember when we first looked at it, you know, first of all, you got to love the title, Crimes of Capitalism, right? And then you tune in and it's these two, you know, very young women talking about socialism. And I'm trying to think, you know, 5-10 years ago, you know, would this, I mean, certainly that's not a show that you're going to find on, you know, CBS necessarily. But I don't know. I mean, maybe that's a trend. So I guess that's a question for you. To your point, a lot of times these things, they start on the fringes, but they move towards the mainstream, right?
Yeah, I think there is that possibility. And towards the end of the book, I recommend to the mainstream media, which have all newspapers and, you know, the main TV networks have all been losing audience. If you want to build your audience back up, stop, you know, going for just this upscale group, you know, open it up and go back for a mass audience again. You got a lot of people to talk to, you know, make a bigger tent and, you know, it's a democratic process, journalism. And so it should be democratic in its appeal. It shouldn't be just for, you know, a little elite niche.
But doesn't that beg the question about why they went to the direction that they went to? It was about making sure that the profits were there.
Yeah.
And so if that doesn't change, then what is the incentive to add a bigger tent?
Yeah. I think the incentive now is that the profits are down. Like a lot of newspapers are really suffering.
That's right.
It hasn't hit the TV networks in a big way, but they're losing. I mean, they're losing out too. There's just too many things pulling people in different directions. And I think if you're much more, populist, and I mean that in an open good way, not in a mean evil way. But if you open it up to a lot of people and speak about their lives, I think people's ears will perk up. And I think, you know, we've seen it around the edges again in certain digital media and Teen Vogue and in podcasts. And I think people would really be interested in listening to that.
We're talking with Christopher Martin. He's a journalism professor out in Iowa. Before we let you go, Professor Martin, I think I know the answer, but you know, the title is kind of, people love to talk about how, you know, things are going to hell in a handbasket. I mean, we do too. I mean, it's, to use Ed's term, it's sexy. It's, you know, it gets people listening and all that. But it sounds like you might be a little bit hopeful. Is that right?
Yeah, I am actually. I mean, there's it's not just in the past few years, but you can go back to Occupy Wall Street, which is, you know, about 10 years ago. And there, you know, people said, well, there's no leader here. This isn't any kind of movement. But it did start to change our language and thinking about like the 99% and the 1%. And I think that kind of opened up some, you know, talking. And I think it opened up, you know, people to talk about that in politics, but also in journalism. And, you know, that's just kind of a regular thing that people would say these days. So I think even if you're not talking specifically about labor unions, to do a critique of capitalism, to do a critique without even using lots, you know, even the words of capitalism, just saying, hey, this isn't working very well right now. We got to, you know, do something a little bit different. I think that's kind of how you start to bring people in. So I do remain hopeful. I think we're moving in that direction.
Last question. You guys are looking to start up school. Are you doing in Iowa? Are you going virtual? What's the situation at the moment?
Well, the good thing, again, we have a labor union at the University of Northern Iowa. So everyone had the option. Mm-hmm. So you could do it in person and they're trying to, you know, distance people. You could do hybrid and meet. I'm actually just going to meet, for the most part, just online, mm-hmm. although I'll be willing to meet with students one-on-one in person. So the reason I did that is that I think like in the next few weeks, it's just all going to go that way. So, you know, just like we've seen it with football kind of kick off and kind of be delayed. I think it's going to happen to us too.
How big is North?
Ed, we got to run, Ed. Sorry, Professor Martin, we'll have you back on. We're out of time. Christopher Martin is professor of digital journalism, University of Northern Iowa, author of No Longer Newsworthy, How the Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Your Rights at Work. We will see you next week. Thanks for listening.
All right, everybody. Take care.
This is a public service announcement with guitar.
WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Mohammed. Here are some headlines. The number of Americans applying for unemployment dropped last week, slipping below 1 million for the first time since the economic shutdown sparked by the coronavirus pandemic began in the spring. The number of new applications for benefits, a rough gauge of layoffs, declined to 963,000, the Labor Department said today. It was a second straight drop from 1.2 million the previous week. And it's the first time weekly claims have dipped below 1 million since the week ending March 14th, with the figure sharply below the 1.25 million some economists had expected. Still, the downward slide does not mean the economy has rebounded. In 21 weeks, 56 million workers filed for unemployment compensation. The United States reported roughly 1,500 new coronavirus deaths on Wednesday, the highest one-day total of the month and one of the deadliest days of the U.S. epidemic since May. Kentucky reported more than 1,000 new infections, a single-day record. In Kansas, the Hutchinson State Prison has gone into lockdown after 84 prisoners and 10 staff members tested positive for coronavirus. President Trump publicly introduced the new head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Dr. Scott Atlas is a radiologist with no experience in infectious diseases. His ideas frequently line up with Trump as opposed to science. Dr. Atlas has promoted school reopenings and previously suggested curtailing public health measures to allow the U.S. to reach coronavirus herd immunity. Coronavirus relief talks hit a wall again yesterday, increasing the likelihood that there won't be a deal until at least September. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer issued a statement saying there's no reason for further discussions at this point, since the White House isn't changing positions on numerous policy fights. Among the key outstanding issues is the overall cost of the relief package. Democrats offered to drop $1 trillion off their roughly $3.5 trillion price tag if the administration agreed to add the same amount to its roughly $1 trillion package, but the White House rejected that strategy. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security and the Secret Service demanding information about uniformed federal officers who held two black mothers at gunpoint and detained them without explanation. The two women had planned to take their sons to the fountains at the World War II Memorial July 30th, but before they could leave their car, a Secret Service vehicle drove into their front bumper. Secret Service cops swarmed the car and handcuffed the mothers, keeping them from their crying children for an hour. A grand jury indicted two Indianapolis police officers on battery and other charges following an investigation into allegations that they used excessive force while arresting two women at a May protest over the death of George Floyd. Two women filed a federal lawsuit in June after a video was released of officers using batons and pepper balls to subdue them during the May 31st arrests in downtown Indianapolis. The officers have been on administrative leave since the incident. Both officers are expected to make their first court appearances today. and the Salt Lake City Police Department has suspended its K-9 unit a day after body cam footage was published showing an officer ordering his police dog to attack a black man kneeling on the ground with his hands in the air. In the April 24th video, the man, Jeffrey Ryans, repeatedly shouts in pain and asks, "Why is the dog biting him?" The canine officer involved in the encounter appears to say, "Hit,